and IPC. And on the theory side, most of the theory work was done by Katja Reed, who just graduated her PhD earlier this year. This is the article on the archive. And of course, the experiment was done in Kevin Rush's lab by JP. And JP is going to give the second half of the talk, where he's going to tell you about the experiment. And I'm going to try to give you some of the theoretical background. So the idea is to theoretically explore and then look for experimental signatures of what we're going to call quantum coherent mixtures of different kinds of causal relations, in particular cause-effect and common cause relations. But I find that when I talk about this, people often get confused about a previous project we did on quantum causation. So I just want to start this talk by telling you a little bit about that previous project and how this new project relates to that. So the first project was about causal inference. Sorry, this is not clicking. Let me just see if it's turned it on. Yep, there we go. Right, causal inference. So the idea of causal inference is that you observe some variables, you see that they're correlated in some way, and you try to figure out what causes what. So in a really simple example, you've done a drug trial, you've seen a correlation between taking a drug and recovering, and you're trying to infer from that what's happening causally. So you might say, well, those correlations could be explained by the fact that the drug actually has a causal influence on your likelihood of recovering. But it turns out for any correlations you see, an equally good explanation is just that there's no causal influence from one to the other, and there's a common cause that explains exactly the correlations you've seen. So in this example, for the illness in question, it could be that men are more likely to recover than women are for this illness. And it just so happens that men are more likely to agree to take this treatment than women are. And that creates a correlation between the two. And it's in that case, it would not be any evidence of a causal link. So classically, if you just have this distribution over two variables, there's really no way of discriminating those two causal possibilities. But quantum mechanically, what we show is that you can do something for this problem. So this is a kind of picture of what this same question looks like in a more circuit diagram type approach. So now A and B are not variables, but they're quantum systems. And to say that A is the cause of B means that A is the input of some gate in a circuit of which B is the output. Whereas if I think that A and B are correlated by virtue of a common cause, then it means that the quantum systems A and B were the two outputs of some joint preparation, such as a correlated or entangled state. And so now the project is to look at, by probing quantum systems A and B, doing measurements on them, and looking at the sorts of correlations you get, can you determine which of these two possibilities you have? So you can imagine that everything inside this dashed box is hidden from you, and it's your job to estimate whether it's this kind of circuit or that kind of circuit based on the correlations you observe. So that's what this portrays. You've got some measurement here. The system survives, gets fed back in here. You've got a measurement at the end. You get to choose what measurements you're doing. You register the outcomes. You look at the statistics, and you're trying to figure out what's happening inside. So I'm not going to tell you very much about this at all, except to give you an example of how this is possible, that you could distinguish cause-effect from common cause. So here's an example. Suppose you do this, and you choose to measure poly-X measurements early and late, and you find that their outcomes are perfectly correlated. And then on the same situation, you also measure poly-Y and poly-Y. You find that the outcomes are perfectly correlated. Z and Z, you find they're perfectly correlated. So you ask, well, what could that be? Answer, if this were the identity gate, that's exactly what I see. So that explains what you've seen, that it's a cause-effect relation with the identity gate here. If you then ask, is there any explanation in terms of a joint state like this? The answer is no. There is no bipartite quantum state that gives perfect correlations for all three of those poly pairs. That would be something like an anti-singlet state, and it's not there. It doesn't exist. So you can rule out any explanation of this form. So you know when you see that pattern, wasn't common cause, had to have been cause-effect. And if you do the same sets of measurements, and you start seeing perfectly anti-correlated outcomes, so you do XX, you see anti-correlation, similarly with YY and ZZ, then you know that the singlet state can explain that very easily because it has that pattern. And it turns out that there is no gate that has that pattern of correlations. So the map that would achieve that is the transpose map, and that's not a completely positive map. And so you know it couldn't have been a cause-effect structure inside there. It must have been common cause. Okay, so there's much more to the story, but that's the basic idea, that quantum mechanics affords new possibilities, quantum advantages for figuring out what the causal structure is based on observed correlations. Okay, and if you're interested to see more details, you can go look at this paper. But this talk is about this other paper, which is up on the archive, and I mentioned at the beginning. And here we're going further than the previous one in the sense that we're now considering a new causal possibility, which is that there's a cause-effect relation and a common cause both acting together or mixed in some way. So previously it was always just one or the other. Now we're imagining that both could be acting. So in the case of the drug trial, of course, we know that you could have both of those effects that I mentioned earlier happening in the same drug trial. In terms of circuits, this was the circuit for the cause-effect, this was the circuit for common cause. If you ask, well, what kinds of circuit would have both a cause-effect and a common cause acting? Well, this is an example, right? If I prepare A and some ancilla system in some joint state, and then I do some sort of non-trivial unitary that couples A and that ancilla system and throws away the ancilla and just outputs B. So if there's a non-trivial link here and a non-trivial in a non-factorizing state here, then I have both of these sorts of causal influences in the same experiment. And so what we were interested in is there some sense in which we could imagine these two causal relations here being combined coherently? So in the sense of a quantum coherent combination. And the kinds of things that we normally combine quantum coherently are vectors in Hilbert space. Maybe even we could talk about the coherence between systems in an entangled state or between systems at two times in terms of channels. But causal relations are not the sorts of things that we usually talk about as just being combined coherently. So we have a problem, which is it's not clear what is the right definition of that notion. So we have to think hard about, does it even make sense to talk about what a coherent mixture of two causal relations might be? So I'm going to be talking about what our proposal is for how we should define that notion. And we welcome suggestions for maybe, better proposals than the one we have, but I'll tell you what our idea was. So the first thing I'm going to mention is that that old experiment I mentioned in the beginning, it was important that you were measuring in an observational kind of way. So even classically, if you do what's called an interventional probing scheme, so you do a randomized drug trial, for example, then really you don't have a single variable here, treatment. You have two variables. You have what the patient would have preferred to do, take the drug or not, and then you have what gets assigned to them, placebo or drug. And if you're doing the randomized trial properly, you basically make it completely random, so whether they get the placebo or the drug. So it becomes totally uncorrelated with what their preference is. And now you really have two variables. And if you see correlations between recovery and this randomly assigned treatment, you know there had to have been a cause-effect, that the drug had some influence on recovery. And if you see a correlation between recovery and treatment preference, you know that there was some sort of confounding factor which influenced both. So if you do it this way, now normally people don't keep track of this because they don't really care if there's a confounding factor. If you're doing the randomized trial, this is what you're really interested in. But if you did it this way, you would learn everything about the causal structure, and you could conclude, for instance, if both of those effects were there, common cause and cause effect. And so because we're interested in probing these new sorts of causal possibilities, we're going to allow ourselves to use the strongest possible probing scheme. So we're going to allow quantum analyze of these randomized trials. So I'll just say sort of a notational convention, when I split a variable into two pieces, I now have sort of two copies of it. And our notational convention is just going to be that the prior to probing copy of A will be called C, which stands for common cause related to B. And our post-probing copy of A is going to be called D, which stands for direct cause related to B. So that's how you can remember. C and D are versions of A. And this is what the interventional probing scheme looks like. So whereas a strong quantum measurement in this context can be argued to be observational, if you measure something and then re-prepare here in a way that's statistically independent of what you got as a measurement outcome here, that's like your randomized trial in the medical context. So this is the sorts of measurement schemes we're going to be using to try to understand what's going on in terms of cause-effect and common cause relations in the dashed box. Okay, let me say a couple of words about what the mathematical object that represents the thing that we're probing. So suppose these were all classical systems, B, C, and D. Well, this little circuit fragment here in the dashed box has an input, D, and outputs B and C. So the most general object that describes this is just some conditional probability CB given D. I feed in a distribution over the values of D. This thing allows me to transform it into a distribution over B and C. It satisfies some extra constraints. For instance, C, the final distribution of C, can't depend on what I've put in D because C is earlier than D in time. So it's not a channel from D to C. There's no retrocausation here. So there'll be a constraint that says the distribution over C is going to be, you know, the marginal distribution over C is going to be independent of what you feed in on D. But it's still this sort of object, a conditional probability. And then the quantum analog is just you replace that with a completely positive trace-preserving linear map. Takes in a quantum state D, returns a joint state over B and C, and it satisfies the constraint that the marginal state on C doesn't depend on what you've put into D. Okay, so that's the kind of thing that we would need. That's the object in terms of which we'll have to express any proposal for what a coherent mixture of common cause and cause effect might be. All right, so first I want to say something about the different ways in which you could mix cause-effect and common cause in a classical theory. Okay, so I'm going to introduce this distinction between a probabilistic mixture of common cause and cause-effect relations and what we call a physical mixture of common cause and cause-effect relations. So the origin of the terminology is, you know, if you think about the distinction, for instance, between having a probabilistic mixture of orange juice and vodka, it might be that, you know, I have a glass in this box and you don't know, maybe it's all vodka, maybe it's orange juice. But I could also give you, you know, half vodka, half orange juice, and that's the physical mixture where they're both present. And so that's the idea, that if they're both present, we're gonna call that a physical mixture. Okay, so this is, I'm gonna give a precise definition later on, but this is just to give you the flavor. So the probabilistic mixture would be something like if half the time, you know, there's just a gate that takes D to B, and half the time there's this joint preparation of B and C, and D just gets thrown away, then because this is cause-effect and this is common cause, this is a probabilistic mixture of the two, whereas that earlier example where there's a non-trivial connection here and some non-trivial correlations here would be a physical mixture. Okay. But we're going to be more precise about this in a moment. The key idea for our definition of what a coherent mixture should be is based on a classical phenomena of statistics called Bergson's paradox. So I'm gonna tell you about Bergson's paradox, how it provides a way of determining whether you have a probabilistic or a physical mixture classically, and then how we're gonna use it in the quantum context to define our notion. So if you go to the web looking for nice examples of Bergson's paradox, one of the top hits is a website which is titled something like Why Handsome Men Are Jerks, and explains that fact in terms of Bergson's paradox. So I'll give you that as a starting example. So suppose you're a person who decides whether to date someone or not based on their personality, but based also on their looks. So both those factors are relevant. Then you might observe, after a while, that there's a funny negative correlation among these two traits in the people that you date. And the explanation is just that if somebody's below a certain threshold for personality and looks, you're not gonna date them. And so the only people you end up dating are the people in this category. And overall, therefore, there's a negative correlation. The more general form is just that if you post-select or condition on a common effect of two variables, those variables can become statistically correlated. So even though you assume that these variables are statistically independent in the general population, by post-selecting on a value of their common effect, they become statistically correlated. So by post-selecting on the fact that you would date them, you get a statistical negative correlation between personality and looks in this example. So is that clear? It's not a paradox. They just call it a paradox because it's maybe a bit counterintuitive, but it's just, you know, part of Bayesian probability theory. Okay, so now I'm going to argue that Bergson's paradox gives you a way of distinguishing whether you have a probabilistic or a physical mixture of two causal relations. And so rather than going with cause and effect and common causes in my example, it's just going to be two direct cause relations. So I'm going to be talking about whether I have a physical mixture of two cause-effect relations or a probabilistic mixture of those two cause-effect relations. So in this example, I'm going to talk about the fact that teaching ability and research ability have a causal influence on whether you can get a faculty position or not. So imagine you've got... Well, we're going to consider two kinds of samples. You can tell me which one you think is more representative, or neither. So the first sample of institutions you might consider would be comprehensive institutions that actually care about both the teaching and research abilities of the candidates. So imagine, first of all, that in the general population of applicants, teaching ability and research ability are just uncorrelated. Okay, that's a hypothesis for the purposes of this example. But if the selection criteria are such that they're going to throw out anybody who's both a bad teacher and a bad researcher, and everybody else is equally eligible, then after selecting on those people who succeeded and got faculty positions, the distribution over teaching research has this form, right? So it's now renormalized to this distribution. And again, I see a negative correlation between research ability and teaching ability based purely on the post-selection effect of somebody getting a faculty position. So that's a physical mixture because we're imagining that in every element of the sample, both teaching ability and research ability are relevant to the question of whether you got the faculty position. But imagine a different sample of institutions. So these are specialized institutions, and half the institutions in my sample care only about research, and the other half care only about teaching. So for half of them, they just throw out all the bad teachers, and the other half of them throw out all the bad researchers. And so the entire sample of people who got faculty positions is just the sum of those two distributions, which is this distribution here. So again, we see this negative correlation. It's the same old Bergson effect that by post-selecting on getting the faculty position, you induce a negative correlation between research ability and teaching ability. But it's a weaker negative correlation than we had up here in the physical mixtures. So that's just a representative example, but you can show that actually there's an upper bound on how much correlation you can induce through a Bergson effect if you have a probabilistic mixture. Whereas for physical mixtures, there's not an upper bound on the amount of correlation. You can induce more correlation through a physical mixture. So the strength of that induced correlation can give you a diagnostic for whether you had a probabilistic or a physical mixture. So when you see something like this, you can say, oh, it's not possible that every institution only cared about one or the other. Some of those institutions must have cared about both, and therefore, sometimes both those influences are acting. Okay, now let's go to the case of cause effect and common cause, and we want to try to talk about whether we have probabilistic or physical mixtures there. So it's not so different. So the regular Bergson effect is just if I post-select on B, I can induce correlations between D and this guy over here. But that means that post-selecting on B, I can induce correlations between D and between C, right? So the fact that C is a child of this thing means C is going to be correlated with that thing. So if my post-selection induces correlations here, it'll induce correlations between these two guys as well. So even though I start off with a randomized trial where C and D are marginally independent, if I come in and post-select on B, and I have a mixture of these two causal relations, cause effect and common cause, then I expect to induce correlations between C and D. And now the idea is that the strength of those correlations you induce can tell you something about whether you had a probabilistic mixture of the cause effect and common cause relations or a physical mixture of the cause effect and common cause relations. Good. Now note that it was important that we're using this interventionist probing scheme because that's what guaranteed that prior to the post-selection on B, the distribution over outcomes for the measurements here and here really were statistically independent, like in a properly done medical trial. All right, so in the quantum case, we have the same thing. We can have one of these interventionist probing schemes where the outcomes of the measurements here and here start out completely independent, and we can post-select on B and expect to induce correlations. And now here's the key idea, that if you ask, well, what's the strongest you could hope for in terms of induced correlations? In quantum theory, it's very natural to think, well, there's a particularly strong form of correlation, which is entangled. So that's going to be the basic kernel of the idea of what our definition is that if through Bergson-induced correlations you can generate entanglement between C and D, then we're going to say you have a coherent mixture of the cause-effect and the common cause relation in that dashed box. So, questions so far?
Post-selection, can this be in the form of a classical operation? So that this entanglement had to be there before?
Well, when you say whether this entanglement is there or not, you're kind of taking an ontic sort of language, that entanglement is a way for two things to be, as opposed to a way to know about two things. If you try to ask your parallel question in the classical context, you know, the treatment preference and treatment assignment are statistically independent to start off with, and then I post-select on the recovery variable, and I induce a correlation between them. If you'd said, well, was the correlation there to begin with? Well, if I look at the whole statistical sample of those guys, which are independent, and then I take a sub-ensemble of that sample corresponding to my post-selection, I'll find the correlation in that sub-ensemble. So it's the same thing here, where we're saying that if I want to characterize predictions I could make about measurements here and here by some state, so predictions I can make about here and here based on the post-selection I've just made, and I want to use a state to summarize those predictions, it's an entangled state I'm going to use. But it's still true that originally, before I had post-selected, the overall state for this pair was a factorizing state. They were independent. Does that answer your question?
This is way.
Yeah.
So the only statement you can tell me if this is a question, I'm not saying this, but it's a question. The only statement you can make is if you find entanglement between D and or correlations between D and C under your assumption that D is an interventionist measurement, then you know that there is this, like the D is kind of common cause plus cause and effect.
Not quite. So there's going to be we're going to come to it in a moment, but there's going to be many ways in which cause-effect and common cause can be combined. So we're going to have a little classification scheme. But the kind of most exotic way in which they can be combined, namely coherently, quantum coherently, what's going to be distinct about that particular category is that it's going to have this effect that when I do the Bergson-induced correlations, I find they're entangled.
But you can't rule out. Or can you also rule out
that in that case, you'll be able to rule out that it's a probabilistic mixture. So I'm going to...
Sure. Can you rule out that it's a statistical mixture? It's a real mixture?
A physical mixture. Well, these coherent mixtures are going to be quantum-flavored physical mixtures. So they're going to be a kind of physical mixture, but not every physical mixture is going to be a quantum coherent mixture. Maybe it makes sense for me to go through that, and then we can pause again for questions. Okay, so what does this map from D to BC look like in the case where you have something that's purely cause-effect or purely common cause? So over here, purely cause-effect is just going to be some CP map from D to B tensored with some state preparation on C. And over here, it's going to be just tracing over D and then preparing some joint state on C and B. Okay, what's the rigorous definition of having a probabilistic mixture of cause-effect and common cause relations between systems A and B? So here's the technical definition. So we're going to say it's a probabilistic mixture if there's some hidden variable J, it's some sort of classical switch variable, which acts on B. So it's a cause of B. And for every value of J, either it tells B to depend only on D, or it tells B to depend only on B's common cause with C. So it really sort of tells it, you can only do one or the other, you can't do both. And so for every value of J, it's going to be one or the other. And we'll say that it's a physical mixture if the map is not of that form. OK, so let me say a little bit more about that form of probabilistic mixtures.
Can I ask about that?
Yeah.
Can you know for sure that it's a, or isn't one of these sufficient but not necessary? That's sort of what I'm you can be sure that no probabilistic mixture would explain a certain state, but can you be sure that it's not a physical mixture?
Can you be sure that it's? You could certainly, if you've characterized this, I'm about to show you what the most general form of such a map looks like. So if in my experiment, for example, I were to show that it has that form, then I could know that it is not a physical mixture. So let me show you what that form is. Yep, OK. So in general, one of these maps is just going to be a probabilistic sum of other maps. And so by my assumption, that J that appears in the sum is just, we have to think of that as another variable which influences B and tells it how it's allowed to depend on its parents. So for some values of J, B just depends on D and doesn't depend on the stuff that causes C. And so for those values, I have the purely cause-effect form, which recall was a map from D to B and some state on C. But the J dependence is only allowed to be here in the choice of map, not in the choice of the state on C, because J does not influence C. And by the way, a good reason not to let J influence C is because if I let J influence C, then I wouldn't have a purely cause-effect form here anymore, because J would be a common cause for A and B. And so if I really want to make it a mixture of these cause-effect relations, I can't allow that. And so if I note that this thing doesn't depend on J, I lump these together, I just get some overall map from D to B tensored some state on C. So that's all of these terms can be lumped into one term like that. And all the other terms where B is only allowed to depend on this common cause, they have the common cause form of the map. The J dependence is only in this joint state. I can sum that all up and I get just some overall joint state between B and C. And note that because only B depends on J and not C, that all of these guys have to have the same marginal on C, same as this guy, right? Because as I toggle between values of J, the way that C gets prepared doesn't change. J doesn't have an influence on C. So there's this extra constraint that the marginal is rho C. So that means that every probabilistic mixture can be boiled down to just two terms that look like the cause-effect and the common cause with this extra constraint. So if you find that your map doesn't look like that, then it's a physical mixture.
But if it does look like that,
yep.
Are you sure it's a probabilistic mixture, or couldn't it also be a physical mixture?
Well, the way we're defining things, these are mutually exclusive categories. So it's one or the other, right? So if we're defining probabilistic mixture to mean it can be expressed in this form. Now, it's kind of like separable states. Like maybe you've prepared your separable state in a way that wasn't strictly preparing a mixture of product states. But if I can write it in that form, I say it's boring. It's separable. Same thing here.
Your definition is tied to the quantum formalism? Do you have a
yes.
definition which is independent?
No. This is all just quantum. OK. So that's part of that's, first of all, the distinction between probabilistic and physical. And now quantum coherent is going to be a way of being a physical mixture. So we're going to add some extra criteria on top of being a physical mixture. And so the first criteria is that each of these two pathways, the cause-effect and the common cause, each of these two ways of correlating A and B, should themselves be quantum. Like the things that we can coherently mix together should themselves be quantum things. So we're going to say that each causal mechanism on its own should be quantum. And the way we formalize that is we say, OK, if we want the common cause pathway to be quantum, then you might say, oh, well, then it should be entangled between B and C. But this thing isn't, this object is not just a state on B and C. It has this input D. So what we say is there has to exist a complete basis of states on D such that for every one of those states, if I put it through the map, what I get out is an entangled state. Okay, then I'll say it really is quantum in the common cause pathway. And similarly, if I say, is it quantum in the cause-effect pathway, D to B, I say, well, is there a measurement, a complete basis of states on C, such that for every one of them, when I consider the induced map from D to B that I get by post-selecting on that guy, that map is coherent, meaning it's not an entanglement-breaking channel. So that's another way of saying that D and B are entangled, right? If I were to look at the isomorphic operator to this map, I would find it's entangled. That's the definition. And then finally, and this is the key bit, we want to know that when we post-select on B, we get entanglement between C and D. So the final criterion is that if I do a basis of post-selections over here on B, then the induced map I get from D to C for every one of those outcomes is also coherent, and hence entangled if you look at the isomorphic operator. So to summarize, this is only possible if it is a physical mixture. So I think maybe I got that question earlier. Because if you look at the form of a probabilistic mixture and you project onto a particular basis for B, you'll find, like if I were looking at the isomorphic operator to this guy, in every term I would just induce a product state on C and D. And so it would be a separable state. It would not be entangled. And so I can't get coherent mixtures unless it's a physical mixture. So here's the idea. We have a coherent mixture of common cause and cause effect if it's quantum on both the common cause and cause effect pathways, and it's quantum in these Berkson-induced correlations, and therefore a physical mixture. So this is the classification. We have the maps that are probabilistic mixtures, the maps that are physical mixtures, and then we can ask whether it's classical in both pathways, quantum in both. There would be two other categories here, which I haven't bothered to write down. The quantum coherent ones are the ones that are physical mixtures, which are quantum on both pathways, and they're also a subset of that, and it turns out it's a strict subset of that region. Okay, so I'm going to give you just a few examples of these things and then turn it over to JP. So here's a way of implementing purely cause-effect and purely common cause structures. Prepare a maximally entangled state between A and some ancillary system, and then apply an identity channel to the ancilla and A and call A the B system at the end and trace over the other guy. Or do a swap here. So if you do the swap, you see B and A are in a common cause relationship. They're just prepared in the state 5+. Whereas over here, B and A are in this cause-effect relationship. There's just an identity channel acting between them. So those are going to be the two things that we're trying to coherently combine. And the coherent combination is exactly what we saw in Jeff's talk. It's this square root of swap up unitary, or sometimes called the partial swap unitary, which is just this identity unitary plus I times the swap unitary here with a 1 over root 2 and a phase factor out front. And that intuitively should be sort of coherently interpolating between those two guys. And in fact, we find that it satisfies exactly the definition of being a coherent mixture. It's a physical mixture. It has entanglement in the Berkson-induced correlations. It's quantum on both pathways. So it has everything we want. And if you look at the overall map from D to BC in the isomorphic representation, it's kind of a cause-effect term, a common cause term, and then some cross terms. So if you wanted to see cross terms to say that it's a coherent mixture, there's a representation in which there are cross terms. Okay, so here's the idea. The partial swap circuit here is the thing we're really interested in. But if we understand what we're doing, it'd be nice to distinguish that from all the other classes we have. And so we can easily do that. So if you, for example, just decide to do an incoherent mixture of identity and swap, well, then you have something that's still quantum on both pathways. This is still an identity channel. This is still preparing an entangled state. But it's not a physical mixture. It's a probabilistic mixture. And if you then take this and you dephase A and E in some basis, well, then clearly it's no longer quantum on the pathways, because this just becomes a dephasing channel, and this becomes a separable state because I've dephased 1/2 the entangled state. So this is a probabilistic mixture, but now it's classical on both pathways. And then this is maybe the only non-trivial example. If I dephase on both pathways so that it's not quantum on either, but I allow these classical bits now to be combined, some modulo 2 to give me B, well, then clearly it's not a mixture of depending just on D or B depending just on this guy. It depends on both. So that's an example of a physical mixture that's classical on both pathways. So we want an experiment that distinguishes all those. It turns out that we can't quite get these four, but if you just modify this so that it's a probabilistic mixture of that guy and its flipped version, still a physical mixture, because I can't rewrite it as a probabilistic mixture of guys that are purely cause-effect or common cause. But now we've got four examples which we can all implement with the same scheme, and that's what JP is going to tell you about. Yep.
Thanks. All right, so thanks a lot, Rob, for that introduction. Okay, so basically what I'm gonna do in the second part of this talk is all these ideas that Rob has been presenting you in the first part, I'm gonna explain how we implemented those in the lab. All right, so this is a representation of what we wanna do, very similar to what Rob was drawing. Oh, there we go. So we have a state preparation, which we're gonna prepare in a phi plus state. We've got the gate, and then we have these projective measurements on C, D, and B. And so like all good quantum optics talks, I'm gonna talk about how we produce the source here, how we produce this entangled state real quick, and then I'm gonna move on to talk about the gate. And so for our source, we produced polarization entangled photons in an H, well, our target state at least is an HH plus VV state. So we have a laser here at 790, upconverted to 395. And then we have two sandwiched type 1 SPDC crystals, so spontaneous parametric downconversion crystals, which produced our photons, which we then send over through fiber towards our gate. So the qubits, so again, the qubits in this, in the rest of this talk will be polarization, so H being horizontal and V being vertical. Okay, so now Rob explained to you guys in the beginning how if we want to do this coherent mixture of a cause-effect process with a common cause process, we want to use something like a partial swap. So Jeff made my life a little bit easier in his previous talk because he introduced this already. So what I'm going to do is then try to give a little bit more details on how this partial swap actually works. So here's a representation which looks very similar to what Jeff had in his slide. We've got a displaced Sagnac interferometer where there's two paths, and maybe those are easier to see on the next slide, which I'll show, but basically we're trying to implement a unitary, which is this cos I plus I swap. And the theta here, it shows up because we use two counter-rotating glass plates to adjust this phase. All right, so how does this work? Well, if we were to send photons in at D and at E, there are two possible pathways inside this interferometer. So either the photons can take this clockwise path where they don't see this phase here. One photon can come out at F or the other one can come out at B. So I forgot to say this is a 50-50 beam splitter. This is also a 50-50 beam splitter. And all these black ones are just mirrors. So we've got a clockwise path. There's also a counterclockwise path. And the difference now is if the photons take the clockwise path, they go through these two glass plates and pick up a phase to come out. So when we put those two together, what we have is that we have those two possibilities. Either they take the clockwise path without a phase, or they take the counterclockwise path with a phase. So in the previous presentation, Jeff sort of, you know, sketched out this idea that we can represent this in terms of these projection operators. So really what we want to do is realize this partial swap, but it's a little bit easier to think about what's going on in this gate if we think about the projection onto the symmetric state and the projection also onto the anti-symmetric space. Okay, so if you believe me that this notation here is equivalent to this notation here, then I can explain how this partial swap works based on this notation here. So the idea is the following. When we have two indistinguishable photons which arrive at a beam splitter, so like Jeff said, there's two things that can happen. If they're a projection of the symmetric space, they'll bunch together. So both photons, when they arrive at this beam splitter, will either go in one direction or the other direction. If, on the other hand, they're a projection of the anti-symmetric space, then they'll anti-bunch. So one photon will go in this direction and the other photon will go in this direction. Now the key feature to make this partial swap work is that in the end, so when I was looking over here, we want to measure coincidences between photons arriving at B and F. So if we look back over here, there's only two possible ways in which we can measure coincidences at B and F. So the first one being that the photons bunch. They take this clockwise path, one comes out at F, and then the other one comes out at B. So that's the first way. The second way is that they split up, so they anti-bunch. One photon takes the clockwise path, comes out at F, and the other photon takes the counterclockwise path, picks up a phase, and comes out at B. So importantly, what this gate does, if those two processes are indistinguishable, those two, they will add up quantum mechanically, or at least their amplitudes will add up quantum mechanically. And what we have is a unitary which does the pi plus some phase, which is given by these, and then the pi minus. And that's exactly how our partial swap works. And then the key idea is that by tuning the angle of these plates here, we can go from a cause-effect process where D goes to B and E goes to F. If we change the phase, we can go to this common cause process, which is like a swap, where now E goes to B and D goes to F. Or if we sit somewhere in the middle, this is when we'll do our coherent combination of our common cause process with our cause-effect process. Okay, so here I've just shown this is a characteristic Hong-Mendel interference. So if we were to put two detectors on either end of the beam splitter and look for coincidences when those two photons overlap, that's when we get our bunching and we measure this Hom dip. Okay, so this is how the partial swap works. So the entire setup looks something like this. We've got our state preparation, which I described, and then we've got our gate here, which is our partial swap, and we measure the outputs. What we're interested in doing is trying to understand the different types of causal structures which we can create with this setup. And like Rob said, the most natural thing to do is do these projective measurements on C, on B, and then a re-preparation on D. And that's going to be our probing scheme. So by varying the measurements we do on C, the preparations we do on D, and the measurements we do on B, we're going to go and probe the causal sort of the different types of causal structures which we can create in this dashed box. Does that make sense? All right, cool. Okay, so Rob showed you a picture of this, of these four cases. And so what I'm going to do in this next part is explain to you how by modifying the gate, or the setup which I just showed you, we can achieve the other three cases. So we've got, I sort of quickly explained to you how we can achieve this case. And now what we wanted to do is to use one experimental setup in order to achieve the other three. So that's what I'm going to talk about in this next part. So now the key differences for achieving those other three cases or classes of causal structures. The first one being we're going to add a delay here on the photon. And what that delay does, like in a Hong-Mendel interference experiment, is it removes the interference of those two photons at the beam splitter. And then in order to go from, you know, to do these two classical cases up here where the individual pathways are classical, we use dephasing operations. So we're going to use LCRs. And what the dephasing does is it basically takes our qubits and reduces them to classical bits. So now instead of having a classical pathway, or sorry, instead of having these quantum pathways here, we're going to have like a classical bottleneck, which is our dephasing. And the dephasing takes our qubit and makes it just like a classical bit. Okay, so the first thing we want to do is achieve this case where we've got our pathways are still quantum, but the way in which they're mixed is probabilistic. So that's just saying, you know, 50, like what Rob said, 50% probability we do this cause-effect channel, and with the 50% probability we do with this common cause channel, but those still remain quantum. Okay, so how are we going to do that? Well, this is this idea of changing the delay. And the way this works is that if we, so a key feature for this gate to work is that those two processes which I talked about, where you've got two photons going one way or the photons splitting up and picking up a phase, those processes have to add up quantum mechanically or coherently. And the way we do that is by making them indistinguishable. Well, if we delay one photon with respect to the other when they hit the beam splitter, now those processes become distinguishable, and we no longer have a coherent mixture of a cause-effect and common cause process. We just have a probabilistic mixture, which is set by the reflectivity of the beam splitter, which in our case is just a 50-50. So with 50% probability, we do this, and with 50% probability, we do this. So that's one case. Then the next case, if we want to go from this, what we're calling prob Q, so probabilistic mixture of a quantum cause-effect and quantum common cause, if we want to go to then the classical version of that, we apply these dephasing operators. And so in this case, we're going to dephase on the Pauli Z axis using liquid crystal retarders. So the liquid crystal retarders, I think we also saw this morning, basically they add a voltage-dependent, a phase-dependent, how does this work? Voltage-dependent phase, there we go. And so you can tune the phase that you add to be either 0 or pi along an orthogonal polarization state. And by switching them on and off, we can achieve this dephasing. So we take our qubits and reduce them to classical bits. And now we're in this case where we're doing a classical probabilistic mixture of cause-effect and common cause. OK, and then the last case we want to do is this physical mixture. So I don't really have a good intuition of trying to explain why this works, but it does. So in order to achieve this physical mixture, we start with our coherent case, and then we do the same thing as in the other side where we were dephasing, but now we're going to dephase along different directions of the Bloch sphere. So here for D, so on this path, we're going to dephase in the Y, Pauli Y, with Pauli Y. If we're looking at E, we're going to dephase with this guy here, and then at B, we're going to dephase along the Pauli Z. And that's what's going to give us our physical mixture of a classical cause-effect and classical common cause. Okay, so so the next thing to do is I've sort of sketched out how we can use one experiment to achieve these four different types of causal structures. So the next thing to do is, well, in a sense, we want to be able to do something analogous to quantum state tomography or process tomography. And in this case, we're going to call it causal tomography. And so what that is we want to somehow reconstruct what's happening inside this dash box by making this series of measurements on C, measurements on D, and preparations on D. And so the key feature is that it's analogous to quantum state tomography or process tomography in the sense that it provides an input-output functionality to what's happening inside here. So in the end, we're going to want to have something, reconstruct some operator here. Okay, I don't know what that arrow is not supposed to be there, but basically reconstruct an operator, which when you take the trace with these different projection operators, depending on what we have, it gives you the probability of getting that outcome. Okay, but to give you a little bit of intuition about what this causal map is, I'm just going to do like a brief introduction to the Choi isomorphism, which is what our causal map is based on. Okay, so there's this thing called the Choi isomorphism, which is an isomorphism between channels and bipartite states. And all it says is that, in some sense, a process which is like this, where you've got a CPTP map, or a channel which takes A to B, is equivalent to a bipartite state where I start with a maximally entangled state and take half of that maximally entangled state and pass it through this channel, and the other half I just make it go through. And what I mean when I say they're equivalent is that, well, in the first case, if we want to recover what happens at B, well, we just apply this map to A. Whereas in the second case, if we want to recover what happens at B, we take this formula where I've got my bipartite state here, and I take the matrix multiplication of some object which contains the input state. And so I can recover the output state by using this formula with my input state. And so why am I talking about this? Well, the idea is that this isomorphism, or let me back up one step, with our causal maps, we would like to have a formalism which describes both cause-effect channels, or cause-effect processes, and common cause processes. So a cause-effect process would be like a channel, whereas a common cause process would be like this bipartite state. And it'd be very convenient to have some sort of object or some sort of formalism which treats those on equal footing. So what we're going to do in our case is we're going to call our causal map this object here, because it can both describe bipartite states, but by using this isomorphism, it can also describe channels. So that's the idea behind the causal map. Now, it's a little bit more complicated because we have now one input and two outputs, but the idea remains the same. So this is the map that describes sort of, you know, what's going on in this dashed box. And what we're going to do is do the same thing. So we take our maximally entangled state and apply the map to one half of that maximally entangled state. And so that's our causal map. And we're going to get, for each category, we can reconstruct a causal map which describes the causal structure. OK, so maybe, you know, these things are kind of hard to look at and to get a feeling for what's going on. So I'll just spend a little bit of time trying to give an intuition of how to think about these causal maps. So if we go to the lab, create an identity process with our gate, this is like our cause-effect channel. And then we do measurements on C, B, and D. In this case, we're looking at the six eigenstates of the Pauli observables. So there's a total of 216 measurements. And then we reconstruct an operator which looks like that. OK, and we can do that with a fidelity of 98.2% with the ideal. OK, what's actually going on here? Well, let's just take this first corner and blow that up. So if I take this and blow it up, what I have is actually I've got my H, so this is H density matrix on C, and then something that looks a lot like a maximally entangled state on B and D. So this kind of makes sense. We're doing something that's cause-effect, and so therefore B and D should be correlated. If I look at my other side, now I've got something where it's a tensor product between a state on C and, again, a maximally entangled state on B and D. Okay? So what that means is basically, regardless of what the state is on C, I'm getting a maximally entangled state on B and D. Now, it turns out that the maximally entangled state is the Choi representation of the identity channel. And so this is exactly what we would expect to get if we were to produce an identity channel like this, or a cause-effect process in the lab. OK, we can do the same thing with the common cause process. Now, it's a little bit more complicated. This is a little bit harder to look at. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to split it up into these blue dots and then these yellow dots. And as you'll probably guess, if we look at the blue dots, now we get a maximally entangled state on CB tensored with D. And also, if we look at the yellow squares, we have a maximally entangled state on CB tensored with D. And so the idea is the same. Regardless of what happens on D, I've got a maximally entangled state on C and B. And so that's exactly what we would expect for a common cause process, where I can do whatever I want to D. I can prepare any state I want, C and B, via the initial maximally entangled state are going to be entangled. All right? OK, why did I show you guys this? Well, now we want to do the coherent mixture of those two. So if I'll put my common cause-effect process here, my common cause process here. So that's created by the identity. That's created by the swap. Now my coherent mixture is going to be down here. So we can see that if we look at the real part, that just looks like a mixture of the cause-effect process and the common cause process. So if I take these two, add them together, and renormalize, I get something that looks like this. But now, because we're adding those in a non-probabilistic way, so in a coherent manner, we get these imaginary cross terms on this side. So that's all those cross terms that Rob was showing you. Well, basically, this is the same equation that Rob was showing you, where you have the real part and then these imaginary cross terms just in a graphical representation. OK, and we can do that with a fidelity of 93.7%. So then we go back to the lab, and we go and do each of the other cases. So we had four classes of causal structures: coherent combination, probabilistic mixture of quantum causal structures, and then sort of the two classical versions of those. And we can go to the lab and recreate the causal maps for each of the cases. And so maybe if we start in this corner, this is the same one that I just showed you. This was the coherent mixture of cause effect and common cause. Now we're going to move over to the probabilistic mixture of quantum common cause and quantum cause effect. And if we look at this one now, we see that the difference is, well, we still have the real part hasn't changed, but we've lost these imaginary coherence terms. So those have been highly suppressed. If then we add dephasing, then we move up to this region here. And now what we've done is we take this guy here, and because we've added dephasing, we've reduced our causal structure to something that's entirely classical. And so we would expect that to be described by, say, like a probability distribution, which would be just a diagonal on a density matrix, for example. And so the off-diagonal terms here have been highly suppressed. So that, you know, that makes sense with what we would expect. And then finally, the last case would be this physical mixture. Now, this physical mixture, we've represented it in a different basis. And the reason is that if I had shown that physical mixture in the same basis as this, it would be a little complicated and not very intuitive to look at. But basically, the idea is here is I've used a rotated basis, which makes it clear that, again, all the off-diagonal terms are suppressed, but we just have this diagonal component here. And so that is a good indication that, again, we have something that's classical. OK, so we can do this with fairly high fidelity, which tells us that sort of what we're doing in the lab kind of makes sense. And we think we're doing the right thing. But what we'd really like to do is to apply those metrics that Rob was talking about earlier. So can we sort of apply the definitions that we had in the beginning to kind of determine that this is really a coherent mixture of cause-effect process and common cause process? So in the next part, or in the next part of this talk, I'm going to talk about just the different witnesses that we apply to these different cases in order to determine which class they're in. It's a little bit analogous to experiments that deal with entanglement. So you could go to the lab, reconstruct the density matrix, and then apply criteria to the density matrix. But sometimes it's a little easier just to use an entanglement witness, and that'll tell you right away whether the correlations between whatever quantum state you're looking at are entangled. So we're going to do something very analogous. We're going to define a series of witnesses which can sort of narrow down which causal structure we're looking at. And these are all based on this idea that a post-selection on B induces correlations between D and C, and the strength of those correlations tells us something about the underlying causal structure. So that's the idea that Rob really introduced in the beginning. And so the first thing we want to do is differentiate probabilistic mixtures from these physical mixtures. And in this case, what we're going to do is use the covariance. So a covariance is a measure of how different variables are correlated and how they vary with each other. And so we're going to post-select on values of B and measure the covariance between C and D. Now, it's a slightly different form. What we're actually measuring is a weighted covariance. And in this special case where the marginal on C is maximally mixed, it turns out that you can write this formula into something like this, where this is our causal map, and these are just the Pauli operators. And so here the idea is that if we have a probabilistic mixture, so if our causal structure can be written in something like this, then the covariance, so this thing here, is going to be zero. So it's not an if and only if, but what it means is that if it's non-zero, then we don't have a probabilistic mixture, and we must have something that's physical. So that's one thing we're going to look at. And then the other thing we're going to look at is whether or not the pathways are quantum or classical. So the idea is very similar. In the cause-effect case, we're going to make a post-selection on C and look at correlations between B and D. Reconstruct the operator, which corresponds to sort of all those measurements on B and D, and then apply the negativity criterion. So that's take the partial transpose of this and look for negative eigenvalues. And the negativity criterion basically says that if this is non-zero, then the correlations between B and D must be entangled, or must be strong enough to be entangled. For the common cause case, it's the same idea. Do a pre-selection on D, look at correlations between B and C, reconstruct the operator, calculate a negativity. So that's going to help us determine whether the individual pathways are quantum or classical. And then finally, we want to look at these Bergson-induced correlations. So make a post-selection on B, look at correlations between D and C, reconstruct the operator, which corresponds to those correlations, and then apply the negativity again. All right? So we've got four criteria which we're going to apply to our four different cases or classes of causal structure. And summed up, it makes a diagram that looks like this. So there's a lot of, it's kind of an alphabet soup, but I'll try to walk you through all the different terms. This here is our covariance witness, which measures whether or not we have a physical mixture. Here we've got our looking at entanglement in the cause-effect pathway. This looks at entanglement in the common cause pathway, and this looks at these Bergson entanglement in the Bergson correlations. All right, and so the idea is, again, is that if these are non-zero, then it kind of, in this case, it tells us that we have a physical mixture, and in the other cases, it tells us that we've got quantum correlations. So if we look at these four cases, let's look at the right column first. We see that both of these bars here are non-zero, so this column indicates that we don't have probabilistic mixtures, but we must have physical mixtures. If we look at the two witnesses of cause-effect and common cause, or entanglement in the cause-effect and common cause, we see that the bottom row is non-zero, which means that this row corresponds to our quantum coherence on both pathways. And then really the most interesting case is the one with non-zero Bergson correlations, and this is really sort of our flag, which tells us that the partial swap, which we targeted in the lab, does actually produce a coherent mixture of cause-effect and common cause processes. Okay, so we've done some ongoing work where we're looking at transitions between these different cases. If you want to hear more about that, come and talk to me afterwards. But basically, so if I just want to summarize what we've done, you know, we're sort of interested in looking at the different types of causal structures between two variables, so A and B. Now, in order to probe those causal structures, we had to split up A into D and C. And then what we found is, essentially, you know, the quantum world allows for things to behave differently than in a classical world. And in our case, for causal structures, well, there's actually a way in which you can have different causal structures which are combined in a coherent way, which don't exist in a classical world. And so that's what the goal of this experiment was. And so we built the experiment. We figured out a way to use one gate and a modifications to that gate in order to implement all those different classes of causal structures, which I showed. And then we defined some witnesses in order to sort of quickly determine which class those belong to. Yeah, and I guess, you know, the sort of the most exotic causal structure of these cases was this coherent mixture of cause-effect and common cause relation. And so, you know, now we could ask, okay, well, where do we want to go from here? There's a couple options. You know, we could always think about larger systems or higher dimensions. Larger systems would be, well, this whole project has been just looking at causal structures between two variables. Imagine that now we extend that to three or four. The possibilities and the combinations of causal structures which would be possible would become much more complex. Another thing which we could look into is that you know, we've used this key idea where the strength of induced correlation tells us something about the underlying causal structure. And so what Rob introduced is that by post-selecting on B, if we measure these entanglement correlations between C and D, then that tells us that our causal structure has something quantum in it. So something else that we could ask is, well, how strong can those correlations be? You know, could we violate a Bell inequality with these post-selected induced correlations? So it turns out that we can't do that for qubits, but you know, it's still an open question as to maybe if we go to higher dimension, maybe that's possible. And then something else to look into, you know, the way we've defined these, or is there a more principled way of defining a coherent coherent mixture of causal structures? We sort of used a definition which was based on this, you know, Bergson-induced correlations, but is there another way that we could use to define quantum causal structures? And then also, if you've got any applications, if you've got any ideas for how to use, you know, how to develop or have applications for information processing using these quantum causal structures, come and talk to us. We'd love to know. So thanks a lot for listening in. I'm going to invite Rob back up to the front for questions. And yeah, thank you.
Some questions. Do you mind going back to your slide of the entanglement witnesses? Just the results. Yeah.
Yeah.
So this this witness, the entanglement witness between B and D, and also, you know, between C and B.
Yeah.
In the classical case, they're both zero.
Yeah.
And in the quantum case, they're both, you know, some positive value, and they're equal.
Yeah.
Do those two witnesses give you different information? Like, could you consider a, or could you imagine a, some experiment where, you know, the value of one is zero, but the value of another is non-zero?
I mean, these are sort of independent in the sense that one looks at whether the cause-effect process is quantum coherent. So is there it asks, you know, is there a classical bottleneck that reduces my qubits to classical bits in one case? And then the other one is asking the same question, but for the common cause process. So if you remember, we had those circuits. So I was, you know, we were drawing these circuits here with these dephasing operators. Well, if you were only to put one dephasing operator on one side, then that would be a way of, you know, having entanglement on one side but not on the other.
Okay. So then what class would you put your?
Oh well, when Rob, yeah. So there's actually two more categories down here, right? So you'd have entangled in one but not in the other, and then entangled in the other but not in the first. But those are kind of not as interesting, so we didn't look at those. Sort of, we just looked at the four most interesting cases.
Is it possible to have entanglement in the Bergson correlations, but not in the common cause or cause effect correlations?
It is, yeah.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Mike.
Oh, Mike, yeah. Oh my goodness. Here we go.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, so if the measurement you do on B that induces entanglement, if you imagine just prior to that measurement, dephasing in the basis that you're measuring in, then that necessarily makes the channel from D to B have a classical bottleneck, namely that dephasing operation. And similarly with the common cause channel, you have a classical bottleneck, that dephasing operation. But you can still infer entanglement between C and D. The proposal is that we should not consider that a case of a coherent mixture, because the things that you're mixing together aren't themselves particularly quantum.
If I understand well, would you say that the physical mixture is somehow a superposition of causal order? Is the same of the superposition of quantum state?
So certainly we wouldn't say that there's any superposition of causal order. So two things. Here the causal order is fixed. A is necessarily causally prior to B. Mm. So whether A and B are correlated by virtue of a common cause or by virtue of a cause-effect relation, in both those cases, A is causally prior to B, like temporally prior to B, so there's no ambiguity about which comes first. So this is not meant to be a quantum coherent mixture of causal orders, it's just a quantum coherent mixture of ways that things can be causally related. We don't use the term superposition because I feel like superposition is something that vectors in Hilbert space have, whereas quantum coherent is something I could apply to vectors in Hilbert space, or maybe like two systems that may or may not be entangled. And so it felt better to say two causal relations could be quantum coherent or not. I'm not exactly sure what it would mean to say that they were in superposition, because we're not associating vectors in Hilbert space with those individual causal processes. And maybe just one final comment, which is that what's nice about looking at cause-effect and common cause rather than A cause B and B cause A is that if you take, for example, this our notions here, which is different from the process matrix formalism, these coherent mixtures are in the physical mixture category. But if you ask what's a physical mixture of A causing B and B causing A, that's a closed time-like curve. And so it feels like the only way you could hope to probe that experimentally is if you had some exotic physics that actually allowed you to build closed time-like curves. And you know, I don't expect that to be the case in tabletop experiments. So relative to this way of defining things, I don't see much hope for coherent mixtures of different causal orders.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I have more of a theoretical question. So now the coherent mixture is it's based on different slots, by which I mean, so one of the direct cause relation is mediated from D to B, and then the common cause relation is mediated from, I think, is that C to B?
Do we have, do you want to pull up the slide that has that?
So just, you want to like split this or
So we have two bipartite processes, but they live in different systems. One lives in system D tensor E, the other one living in C tensor E. I'm wondering if you've wondered about having living on the same system, say both on D tensor B by a like entangled measurement. Adding to the common cause.
So in the earlier experiment, which I began with in at the beginning of the first half, when we were starting to investigate this question of can you distinguish common cause from cause effect, we were thinking of that system A as just like a single Hilbert space. And we quickly realized that if you're going to be probing A with some measurement, then you naturally have really two Hilbert spaces. There's sort of the, you've come in, you've done a measurement. There's a difference between what that measurement has taught you about the past of A and what it teaches you about the future of A. If you don't have a mathematical language to represent that difference, then you're kind of stuck. So it was very early on we realized that if you're not just leaving A, but you're actually going in and you're doing an intervention, you really need to be able to talk about those two versions of A by assigning them individual Hilbert spaces. And without an intervention on A, I don't see how you could really learn much about the causal connection between them. More generally, I would say if you look at the literature on quantum causation, so some work that I did a few years back with Matt Liefer tried very hard to keep individual quantum systems being assigned a single Hilbert space. And we've been pushed towards assigning every quantum system two Hilbert spaces. The process matrix formalism that came out of the Vienna group uses two Hilbert spaces for every system. It just seems many different lines of research have all converged on the idea that we really need to consider two versions of the Hilbert space for each system. So I'm becoming quite confident that that's really the way it has to be done.
I guess there's this experimental reason to consider to consist of two Hilbert spaces.
Mm-hmm.
What's the theoretical reason, for example, for the Vienna group to consider two Hilbert spaces?
I guess because you can add a substrate and fill a qubit to the one of these systems. Therefore, the input Hilbert and the output Hilbert are somehow different. So they don't need to be necessarily equal.
So the process matrix formalism is motivated from a very operational point of view. So you want to be able to stick into a system, you know, a measurement, an intervention, whatever you like. And so the input and output Hilbert spaces are sort of meant as sort of an opening where you can do whatever you like. What Matt Liefer and I were trying to do was quite different, less operational. We were trying to say we should think of the formalism of quantum mechanics as describing what we know about these systems in space-time when they have certain causal relations, regardless of, you know, what interventions you've done. So we were trying to just say, okay, there's a state, for example, over time, like if I have, you know, A, B, C all over time, we were trying to come up with a formalism that say, oh, here's an operator that represents what you know about those three systems. And it lives on a Hilbert space, HA, tensor HB, tensor HC. And if you'd like to see theoretical reasons why it's hard to make that work, some co-authors and I put out a paper a few months back basically setting up a set of axioms that you might want a state over time to satisfy and showing that you get a contradiction, showing that, you know, one of those intuitive axioms has to fail. And one of the assumptions of those no-go theorems is that you should assign a single Hilbert space with each of these individual systems. So one way out of the no-go theorem is to apply these, use these pairs of Hilbert spaces. So that's a more theoretical consideration. But, you know, you could also choose not to believe some of the other axioms in our no-go theorem. So there's still room for the possibility that you could get away with just talking about single Hilbert spaces.
So in the setup that you have here,
You have either the identity or the swap that will describe the two.
Sounds like an experimental question. Go ahead.
No. It's actually a theoretical question.
Oh, okay.
So you either have the identity or you have the swap that represent the two possible causal relations. And I think of implementing in a different way where I say I have a control qubit. If it's zero, then I have an identity map. If I have a one, then it does an actual swap. And then I could stick in a superposition for the control qubit. Would that be the same thing as you do there? Would that, in that sense, could that be a superposition of causal relations?
Let me just clarify, you'd also have to post-select on that superposition state, because if you just prepare it in a superposition and trace over it, you just get a mixture of the two. But if you also post-select on that superposition state, then that's what people refer to as the quantum switch. So Giulio Chiarabella wrote an early paper about that, Oreshkov, Costa, and Berkner. So they were using the quantum switch in the context of trying to generate what they call the superposition of different causal orders, A cause B and B cause A. And so there's a paper that came out just a few weeks ago trying to use those ideas to generate a superposition of common cause and cause effect. And I don't quite know what the connection between that work and our approach is. So I hope to be able to answer this question in the future. But there's certain things about their approach that I can immediately see I disagree with. But I'm hopeful that maybe, yes, we can do what we're talking about here with the quantum switch, and that somehow the process matrix approach and our approach converge ultimately. But I don't know right now.
Okay, last question. Okay. So I always get confused when people say they make their system classical. Because you're putting this, I assume what you're doing is you're putting a phase between what you call the logical basis or something like that. But there's always some measurement that can reveal the quantum nature of your system, unless you're in a completely mixed state, as opposed to just a maximally mixed state, as opposed to just a state that's diagonal on your logical basis. So what gives you the justification to call it classical if there's always some quantum measurement? Some measurements, like D, for instance, that would reveal.
Well, so the dephasing operation is not reversible. So if you take a qubit and dephase it, just given that classical bit, which is results, you can't determine what the qubit was beforehand.
It won't behave like a classical bit in all circumstances, right? Because there are measurements where it'll look
in
quantum.
Maybe it's just a semantic issue. In a sense, we're using the term classical in the same way that we, as a community, use the term classical correlation. If I have a separable state, I'll say that these correlations are classical. That's not to say that, a separable state doesn't involve terms which are quantum states drawn from the Bloch sphere, for which I expect to see quantum uncertainty. It's just the way we use the language that separable states are classical correlations. So we're basically saying, if you take a channel and you look at its isomorphic bipartite operator, the criterion for that channel being entanglement breaking is exactly that the isomorphic bipartite operator is separable. And so to dephase is one way to make it separable. And then we say, okay, it's only classical correlations between the input and the output, not quantum.
Okay, let's thank JP and Robert for their talk.